Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Neil Ward, and I'm grateful that you are taking time out of your day to learn more about design educators' paths to tenure. I truly appreciate it. On this episode of Tell It to Neil, we are chatting with Professor of Web Design Dan Wong from New York City College of Technology, part of CUNY, the City University of New York, in New York City. Let's listen in.
Hi, Dan. Thank you for being on Tell It to Neil.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. So let's get started. How did you get into the world of design?
Getting into design was actually a lot of necessity and happenstance. Two things that basically happened when I left graduate school was I moved to New York, and as a lot of people know, whether you live in New York or if you've heard about people living in New York, is that it's incredibly challenging and expensive. So I actually moved to New York to be a fine artist. My background is in fine art, and in order to pay the rent and and find a paying job, I got into design. And one of the motivations for getting into design was because I was an international student. I'm from Canada. And so the options for me required that I find a career that suited my credentials. And given that I had an MF, a fine art MFA, that those jobs would be basically design related, interior designer, graphic designer, industrial designer. It wouldn't include jobs that were in the fine art world. And so that's basically, how I made my decisions. The first few months of living in New York, I considered the three options. I actually seriously considered interior design, and then found that the entry level pay wasn't such that it would give you a living wage in New York. And I also did a year studying industrial design in my undergraduate program, and I also realized that there's few and far between, or those jobs are very challenging to get, and you definitely have to have a degree in industrial design, which I did not. And so my thinking was, well, every corporation or every business needs work, things designed, marketing materials and that sort of thing. So that's what I pursued.
Interesting.
It was an interesting challenge to do because my background, I went through a very traditional fine art Bauhaus education. So the first 2 years was foundation, and you learned drawing, and you learned competition. So composition. So you learned in the first year or two the basics of all of the fine art and design fields. And so I had actually originally gone into fine art or gone into art school because I wanted to be a graphic designer. So it's actually interesting that I kind of did this loop of wanting to be a graphic designer, finding industrial design more challenging and interesting, and then finding that I found too many limitations in that program and moved into sculpture and installation. So once I graduated, I hadn't worked on a computer in years. I had learned a lot of sculpture techniques, and I was basically, my partner at the time, or my husband, my partner at the time, who turned to my husband, said, "You need to buy a computer and software." And I was like, "I don't have the money for a computer. I can't really afford this." I was up until that point, I was always brought up to, pay down your credit cards and like don't live on debt. And he convinced me. He was like, "You know what? This is an investment in your career. You need to tool up and really, teach yourself how to be an effective designer." And so that was the first thing that I did, was to go into debt and buy a computer and software, which was a good investment in the long run.
And that's some really good advice too. Invest in yourself.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Did you find that your education in art and design, do you feel like those principles kind of prepared you to do anything in the design, capital D design world, or?
Definitely. I mean, there was a pretty intense learning curve for me once I decided to take that path. I had to teach myself typography, I had to teach myself layout, I had to teach myself all of the software, so Photoshop and Illustrator and at the time Quark.
Oh my
And
goodness.
yeah, which I mean, Quark is actually a really it was a simple tool to use. I understand why it was the standard at the time, because it was there was only so many things you could do with Quark. But yeah, it was a steep learning curve. But because I had a fine art background, and it was both undergraduate and graduate, there was this sense of aesthetic through all of that. And so it, to me, it wasn't, I was also very much interested in interior design, and I was always looking at magazines. So a lot of design has to do with replication and referencing other design aesthetics.
Yes, and what an amazing place to be in New York City to expand on your education and research to just walk outside or go to an event and you see amazing work.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And another thing that, I think one of the reasons why, because I was a practicing designer for 10 years, or longer, and prior to attending art school, I was actually studying psychology, and I had been seriously considering becoming a psychologist and going into graduate school and studying clinical psychology. And so I was wrapping up my undergraduate degree, and I was working as a research aide at a psychiatric institution. And I was like, oh, this is something that I thought was going to be interesting, but in fact it was a challenge and an environment that I had decided that I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in. That being said, the undergraduate degree was very science-based, and research-based. So I got my research chops and understood the process of doing research on a, with a scientific approach, with that degree. When I stumbled into my first jobs as a designer in New York, it was in a medical communication and pharmaceutical marketing. And at the time, that was kind of like the ugly stepchild industry of the design world. But I was able to, and I was really happy to be able to do this, to mix my understanding of scientific information and my interest in doing design of that material. And so I really felt like, an effective designer really understands the information that they're designing. And in this case, I did understand it because I had that scientific background.
And what an amazing job to be able to combine all of those interests.
Yeah, it was definitely a lot of fun. What I think one of my favorite things to do was to design, launch, and start journals, because you would be able to do the branding for the new journal. You'd be able to determine what the style and aesthetics were of the covers of the journal. And then you also got to get into the nitty-gritty of the internal layouts, the 10-point type, and all of these charts and graphs with like very detailed nitty-gritty information.
Yes, and I would imagine that information was really dense.
It was very, very dense. I was regularly, when it comes to references, you'd be like setting that in like 6-point type, It was very, very dense. Yeah, you were cramming a lot of information on an 8.5 by 11 page.
So, how long did you work in that area?
I actually worked in that area up until when I started teaching.
Oh, perfect. So, when was the aha moment that you thought design education might be for me?
Well, this is actually a really incredibly interesting conversation. At least I think it's an incredibly interesting thing. And it's such a New York experience, and it really goes to show that you need to put yourself out there and just be ready to do it, anything and everything. What happened was a friend of mine, at the time I was running a design and technology firm with my husband. He's a computer programmer developer, and I was actually at the time largely doing print design, but then I would design the interfaces for the websites that he would be working on. A friend of mine said, "Oh, I know somebody who's curating an art show, so why don't you drop by?" I went to this art show, and I'm standing next to this sculpture. And this guy's like wandering around. He was like, "Oh, hey, is that your sculpture?" And I was like, "No, actually, but I am a sculptor, but I do graphic design." And he was like, "Oh, that's interesting, because I'm an architect, but I teach graphic design." And I know. And I was like, "Oh, that's pretty cool." He was like, "Oh, would you like to come in and be a visiting critic for my students?" And I said, "Oh, sure, that would be like a lot of fun." So I did that, and he kept on like he I would I was his regular visiting critic for a number of semesters, and he kept on saying, "You really ought to teach. You really ought to teach." There was times actually when he was being observed when I was coming in and doing my song and dance and like critiquing the students. And the faculty member who observed me said, "You're really great. Do you teach? You should think about teaching." I was like, "Yeah, well, at the time I actually didn't think that I could teach legally, because I thought I needed a special visa to do that. But I contacted my lawyer and said that he said, "Oh, no, it's simple for you. You just need a letter of employment." So after a couple of years, I said, "Oh, you know what? Maybe I'll try teaching a course. It sounds like fun." So I taught one semester at City Tech. I taught a three-dimensional design course, which was kind of easy given being a sculptor. And at the end of that semester, I got a phone call from the department, and the administrative assistant said, "Would you like to come in for the web job?" And I'm like, what do you, I mean, I actually thought that there was a possibility that there was a web project that they wanted me to consider and interview me for. It wasn't really clear. And I was like, "Can you tell me more about the web job? Like, is this some sort of project that you want?" And she seemed really confused. And she was like, "Give me a second." She comes back and she's like, you teach here, right?" And I was like, "Yeah, I do." She's like, "Do you want to come in for the web job interview?" And I was like, "Okay, why not?" I really had no idea what I was interviewing for. I had Googled it, and I did see that there was a job, a tenure track position that they were advertising, but I didn't know whether or not I was. So I actually went in with my portfolio, fully expecting to like talk about some sort of web project that they needed. And then I walked in, and they said, "Oh, by the way, you're interviewing for a tenure track position." And I was like, "Oh, okay. Well, I'm not sure that I want a tenure track position, because business is really good. But let's do this interview anyways." And so like I went through the jumped through the hoops and did it. And I said, "One of the things is business is really good with my business." And my husband had been, I mean, at that time, gay marriage wasn't legal. So really, it was really important. I had been in the country for 10 years, Corporations were not willing to sponsor me for a green card. So what happened was he started a business, we worked together, and this business was going to sponsor me for a green card. And so I asked them, well, business is good and I'm trying to get a green card. And they said, oh, well, we can actually get you a green card and we can expedite it because for faculty positions, because they're publicly like internationally advertised and they really go through the process to see who's available, that if they need a green card, they can expedite it and they can get it done in 2 years. So
Ooh, that's nice.
it's great. And so I thought, okay, well, you know what? They'll pay for all the legal fees. So I was like, okay, well, you know what? I'll do this. I'll get my green card in 2 years and see how it goes. And it's now like 11 years later. I mean, I quickly found that academia was the right place for me. I really enjoyed teaching the students, and I really liked the environment. I like the fact that it's very self-motivated. So you work on what you're interested in working on, and that you interact with people. The people are there's, the faculty is always the same, the students are always changing, and the fact that you really do impact the students' lives in really positive ways.
Which is extremely rewarding.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Particularly for our school, I mean, we're a public institution. All of our students come from the public school system, the New York City public school system, which doesn't have the best reputation. And also the students also don't necessarily, they come from very impoverished or working class backgrounds. So they are both challenged by life. They often have part-time or full-time jobs while they're going to school, or they have major family responsibilities in addition to being full-time students. And their parents are not necessarily professionals. So not only are they often the first times to go to university, but I find that if they work hard and they apply themselves and they take every opportunity that we offer them, they do very well. And sometimes and oftentimes do much better than we do as educators.
You've been in this position for 10 years now, right? Or so?
Yes,
Okay.
10 or 11. Actually, this is the 11th year because I started in 2008.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
And web design has changed quite a bit over the past 10 years. But certain things have kind of remained the same. So I'm kind of interested to pick your brain on how you've addressed those changes over those years and kind of what the projects you're doing now with your students.
In some ways, the projects haven't changed. The complexity of them is, has changed. Given that the courses are 15 weeks, there's only so much that can be done in that short amount of time. And so, I've always designed my courses for success. That's my goal. Like if I don't get most people to create a successful project by the end of the course, then I have failed. So I do everything possible to keep the standards to a point that they will find success within the course. Now, in terms of keeping up with technology, I gotta say, sometimes I really envy the drawing professors in our program.
Why is that?
Well, because I mean, drawing is drawing is drawing. I mean, like drawing, I mean, some of the tools slightly change, but really, when you are a master illustrator, let's say, your approach to teaching doesn't change that much. You do life drawings, you do, still lives, You do figure drawing. Like, that has never changed, and that really will never change. And the technicalities of perspective and what have you, that kind of stuff doesn't change. You need to learn some of the latest tools, but you could also just really teach students to draw using paper and ink and pencils. So, whereas with technology, it's changing, it changes exponentially. It's really hard to predict where the direction is going. A perfect example is Flash. Flash was never an easy tool to use, and it was always a difficult thing to teach because, it's easy to do a simple animation, but if you really wanted to be effective at it, you had to get into action scripting and coding, which is really, really difficult for most creatives. It's work intensive. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort.
Yes, it did.
And yes, and then it's gone. Like, it's gone in a split second. I mean, it literally, the beginning of its demise was when Apple refused to support the Flash player on its phone. And so I had two courses that I had written that were Flash focused. And when Flash was dying, I struggled to figure out what was going to replace it. And for a time, there was this prototype of called Edge Animate, which is now called Adobe Animate. And so we were teaching that for a while, but then there became a licensing problem because it was in beta. We couldn't get a license for it. And Adobe wasn't really helping us out getting licenses for it to teach. But the fact is that that didn't replace Flash. What replaced Flash was rich media, because the cool interactivity things that Flash was being used for, you don't do on a phone. You don't do hover effects, and you don't, there's a lot of things that you don't do on a typical website on a phone. With a phone, you just click and play. And so that click and play thing basically introduced things like podcasts, video, and it brought back animated GIFs. And so really those are the things that replaced Flash. And you could never predict that that was gonna, I mean, maybe some people would have predicted it, but it's really hindsight that you realize that, oh, when Flash died, it went in a totally different direction. So that's just an example of, there's technology which is very complex to teach to design students. And then there's just like predicting the trajectory of technology.
That makes so much sense, and it's so funny because I, for educators that have been around for a while, when you mention animated GIF, the first thing that comes to mind is something extremely brightly colored and flashing.
The animated GIFs of the 90s, yeah, they were just horrendous and hideous, and nobody ever wanted to use them.
No. And now, when we say animated GIFs, they're a lot better to look
Yeah.
at.
They're basically just mini stripped down 5 second videos.
Yes.
And
Totally different connotations.
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's pretty cool.
So, are you working on any scholarly projects?
I think it was 2014, prior to, just as I was approaching my tenure review, up until that point, professional practice had been recognized as research, and then suddenly it wasn't. And so I looked around for opportunities to do some more traditional forms of scholarship and research. And And just backing up a little bit, you know, we have to remember that in our field, the terminal degree is the MFA. And for the most part, MFAs, at least my generation, and I think even still a lot of programs, MFA programs, are creative professional practice programs. They are not academic research programs. So when you compare those to other academics, people who get their credentials and their jobs, it's a PhD. And so within those fields of study, they are taught how to write a research paper, how to do research, what is research in the field. And so when they get their first tenure track job, they've possibly already been published. They hit the ground running, and they know exactly how things are done. And then they pick their little niche, their tiny little, like, flies on a specific, wings on a specific fly and how flies fly, kind of granular research, and then go for it. And so in our field, research itself is not defined. The methodologies by which we're expected to do research is not defined. You know, publishing opportunity.
No, that is something that is really wide open and under the guise of peer review.
Right, right. And, you know, there are journals and such that we can publish in, but even there, you know, we have to do research to figure out, number one, what the journals are, number two, what they're looking for, number three, we have to teach ourselves how to write. How to do, you know, there's all of these things that PhDs come with a toolkit. They've already had that. We're kind of in the dark. And then, you know, many people go into design not because they are interested in that, but because they are creatives. And so the flip side for us is this ridiculous notion that we can take our design work, which in some ways they think we're going to do in a bubble without a client, and then present it in exhibitions, like fine artists present in exhibitions. But, you know, there, it's not like there's design exhibitions and design galleries all over the place. I mean, those kind of things don't really exist. We don't work within a bubble. We, you know, for the most part, work with clients. And so it's a little bit disingenuous in some ways for the academy to be comparing our field to disciplines that have existed for hundreds of years. And then on top of that, our discipline has been changing so drastically and so rapidly over the past 20 and 30 years. I mean, you think about how print was ubiquitous for so long, and then the internet came along and print publishing was decimated, and that was our field of expertise. And so there are people who are designers, visual designers with print backgrounds, having to retool. Then you have, you know, interactive designers who, like, what is that? What is not only what is that, but, you know, what is the research for that, and what kind of work are you supposed to be doing? And on top of that, the landscape is changing so rapidly. I teach this one course called Web Analytics and Traffic, and literally within the semester, I'll have said something, and then within weeks, Facebook will have changed their algorithm, or Google will have changed their reporting structure, and I'll have to go back. I know, and I'll have to go back and say, oops, like, oh yeah, things have changed. What I told you last week is no longer true. There was last semester, the semester before, where Twitter went from 140 characters to 280 characters. And I was like, yeah, you know, Twitter, 140 characters. And one of the students put his hand up and he's like, you mean 280? And I was like, Yeah, I kind of noticed lately that there was, I could put more in a tweet, but I didn't know that what is going on. They're like, oh yeah, they changed it to 280. That was the impetus for creating Design Incubation. Actually, the original impetus for creating Design Incubation was my frustration with professional practice not being recognized as research. And so I thought, we need to create an organization and a venue for people to present their professional practice under the lens of academic, interrogation and review and presentation. So that was the original, the original purpose of it. And it was really kind of, it was an invitation. It was by invitation. We were, we'd reach out to, other faculty members. It was myself, Catherine Weinstein at Queen's College, and, Genevieve Hitchings at City Tech. And we would invite people that we knew around New York who were doing interesting stuff. And we said, hey, will you present your work? And in a colloquium kind of structure, we limited it to Petra Kucha because that way we wouldn't bore each other to tears.
yes.
and it was a hit. Like the very first one was a hit. And every single one after that, people came around really inspired, and just they had gotten so much out of it. As things progressed, and again, this kind of took off right away. It shifted because one thing was that people, full-time educators were really focusing on their teaching, not. They weren't necessarily doing professional practice because they didn't have time to. People, say, in community colleges were not expected to do, a high degree of scholarly activity. And so people were presenting their teaching practices. And so then I began to think about, and we began to think about, well, what is research? Because teaching practices isn't technically pedagogy. I mean, like, pedagogical research is really studying, education, and, doing case studies on how you're teaching a course isn't necessarily studying educational practices per se. And so that's when I began to think about, well, what the heck is research in our field? What is research in other fields?
Yeah, that's definitely important to compare or to have that contrast between what others do, just to have a better idea of how to frame research in our field in those terms.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And some people will say, oh, well, I'm doing this, rebranding, so I'm getting online and I'm looking at other companies and I'm seeing what's going on in trends and I'm seeing what's happening with logo design and colors and then I'm developing my project. And so that background research to them is research. My background actually before I got into the creative areas, the creative fields, I studied cognitive psychology and behavior spent. So it was very experimental. I studied statistics. I actually taught statistics when I graduated from undergrad. I was a research aide at a psychiatric hospital in Toronto. And we were doing really rigorous scientific research. And so I'm familiar with what scientific research looks like, particularly in the social sciences field, which I think is in some ways interesting because, measuring behavior is, we're trying to understand causal relationships or correlations with behaviors is really, in some ways the idea is challenging. It's really hard to quantify, but they've, over hundreds of years managed to be able to measure that kind of thing. So that's kind of my trajectory right now with Design Incubation is trying to begin to, be completely inclusive, allow people to define research in the field in different ways, but also recognize that there actually is a way that we could be doing research in communication design using the tools of science. And in a lot of ways, we're already doing that. You think about, you take surveys, you do interviews, you quantify that, you run statistics on it, and you create hypotheses and determine whether or not these ideas are supported by the feedback that you get from people that you interview. So that's what we've been doing with design incubation. We've been regularly, all presentations are, you know, published, their abstracts are published so that there's a design record. One thing that, again, we are not taught to do in MFA programs are lit reviews.
No, we're not.
Right. And so we're often just reinventing ideas that have been published somewhere that we haven't actually found. And so in the very least, I would like to say, you know, this idea has been presented here at Design Incubation, and this is the person who did it, and this is when they did it. We now practice this double-blind peer review. So when people submit their abstracts for the colloquia, they are sent to two peer reviewers. The people who are doing, the peers who are reviewing it have no idea who authored the abstract. And then we send the reviews back to the author, and they don't know who did the reviews. But we do send them back because given that we haven't been trained in, you know, academic writing and academic research, part of our mission is to move the discipline forward and educate the educators. I'm not sure the exact statistics in terms of how many people we reject and how many people we accept. I would say it's not unlike, you know, the typical classroom setting. It's a bit of a bell curve. So there's that, like, you know, that there's that top few that are just like, you're excellent. Everything that you do and write about is excellent. You are accepted. Then we get the ones that are, please read the reviews and edit your abstract. And upon, you know, accept, you know, review, doing those edits, we will accept you for presentation. And then there's those that are just inappropriate, topic-wise, poorly written, don't really have a thesis whatsoever. And to them, basically, we would say, you know, unfortunately, you were rejected, but read these reviews and resubmit. And if you resubmit, we will re-review them. And if we can get it to a point in time, we will accept you for presentation. And if it's not in time, continue to edit it. And we will, you know, keep on working on it. And if you get to the point where, well, we'll accept you, we're doing colloquia on a regular basis. So you can be, you know, you can present at one of our many colloquia. But yeah, so that's, you know, then we kind of branched out to other things, like, again, one of these ridiculous things of awards competitions. So, you know, for tenure and promotion, if you win an award for the work that you've done, then that is, you know, high acclaim. Well, in our field, it's, you know, we're competing with people in industry. We're competing with people that have like $3 million budgets and can pay the $350 entrance fee to the Webby Awards with a chance of actually winning. I mean, for academics, we're working full time. We're not, for the most part, allowed to work that much on professional activity outside of our jobs. So the idea that we could possibly get, you know, a project that is going to win an award that will be recognized for tenure promotion is a bit ridiculous. So we, you know, we specifically came up with the Design Educators Awards to recognize educators and their efforts in service and teaching, publishing, and creative work, specifically outside the realm of industry, so that they had a chance of actually being recognized for something.
Yes.
And we've been getting some really amazing submissions. And then we get some submissions where it's kind of like they're taking a stab at it, but you know, they're not there yet. In some ways, you know, it's unfortunate. What we would actually really like people to do, because oftentimes, you know, you can only have like one or maybe two winners in a category. And sometimes we actually would like to recognize more than that many, but you can only have that many. So I think people might get discouraged because you only work on like a handful of really in-depth research projects in your professional career. And so I would say to anybody who is listening to this, just because you didn't win doesn't mean that you are not deserving. And I would like say, hey, keep on submitting to these awards, because it's one of those things of, you know, there are good submissions that just we can't recognize everybody.
That's really good advice. Keep trying.
Keep trying. Exactly. I often think about actors and I'm just like, their lives are full of rejection. I could never be an actor, but you know, people who keep on trying will eventually find success.
Exactly. No, but the design incubation, I've been involved in a few, or I've been involved in a colloquium, mm-hmm. In a panel presentation, mm-hmm. And most recently submitting to the Design Educator Awards. Mm-hmm. And I find that the organization as a whole is really a really great resource for us design educators. It's really
fun. Yeah.
There's that opportunity for peer-reviewed awards, mm-hmm. And other peer-reviewed opportunities that can be recorded on your CV.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And the more I meet people, the more I talk about design incubation.
Which is great. Yeah.
Yeah. And the more people that I can tell about it, the more people know about it. So I'm there to support you. I'm an advocate for design incubation.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, so we're a fully volunteer organization that works on zero revenue. I mean, we have a small fee for the fellowship program, the writing fellowship program. And we have a very small fee for the awards. And then other than that, it's really all people donating their time, their expertise and space in their institution. And you know, it would be really great. We've often thought, how do we monetize this? Because we could just really use a little bit more money. So, just to, you know, put stamps on envelopes and that sort of thing. But you know, it's a work of love, and we're always looking for people to be peer reviewers. We're actually in the midst of putting together a peer review webinar because there are, you know, different criteria for peer review for different things. You know, there's criteria for journals, and each journal is going to be different. There's books. There's conferences and such. And so we're going to be, you know, putting a presentation together so that people will understand how to peer review, what, you know, what the criteria are and what the, you know, the definitions of those criteria. We're also going to be putting together a webinar on how to write an abstract. They have been getting better, but they're still surprisingly not great. I wrote this with colleagues, wrote this white paper on how to write an academic abstract. And again, this a lot of this came from my experience in studying cognitive psychology. You know, there's thesis and there's you know, research and ideas and thesis and crunching the numbers and observations and outcomes and conclusions and that sort of thing. And there's a general structure. And if you were to follow this structure, it is pretty easy to knock out an abstract. And also, if you can't answer all of these criteria, then perhaps your abstract is not substantial enough to be presenting. So there's now a wizard. Do you know about the wizard, the abstract wizard?
I do not. Please tell
me. Oh, okay. Yes. So there is an abstract wizard on the Design Incubation website. And basically it's like, you know, give me one line that gives, that explains the title of your research and give me your, you know, the background, you know, two sentences for the background information and one sentence for your hypothesis and blah, blah, blah. And basically just breaks it down into component parts. And it's not really meant to give you a finished abstract, but it's basically to give you the outline of an abstract with all of the components that you will need to be able to massage and craft for submission to, you know, what have you, journals or conferences or whatever.
I was going to say, wait a second, I just put in a couple sentences and it writes it for me. That's amazing.
Yeah. Basically. Yeah. It's a little wizard. And I'm hoping that it'll help people. So, we're always growing and changing, and we're always looking for volunteers to help us out, because our discipline, you know, we're a really hot discipline, I've got to say. You know, communication design is everything that we see in front of us, all the technology that we use, presents information that requires designers to figure out how to present. So there's that. One other thing that, you know, I've thought about quite a bit with my scholarly activity and you know, it often informs itself in what we do with design incubation is, how does industry differ from academia? You know, in so many ways, in so many fields, academia is the leading charge. You know, a lot of discoveries happen in universities that change and revolutionize the world in medicine and physics and, you know, what have you. And in a lot of ways, well, first of all, communication design was the ugly stepchild of like the fine art departments in art and design
schools. Always.
Yeah, it's just like, you're doing what? That's so not cool. But now it's like, that's, you know, I from what I'm hearing, fine art departments are shrinking rapidly because everybody wants to be studying design. And so, you know, we're really changing and growing, and I don't see the internet going away, and I don't see technology going away. Hence, I think that our jobs are going to be around for a really long time, but they're also just so changing rapidly.
Well, and that's what also gets me thinking about kind of not necessarily a new area, but in user experience and user experience designers, mm-hmm. that's kind of at the edge of graphic design, and it's kind of at the edge of computer science, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and it's kind of at the edge of, I don't know, analytics, maybe, mm-hmm. data analytics, mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. So it's just like right at the edge of all of these areas. And with user experience design, what type of research and what type of peer review would be applicable there, mm-hmm. for that?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just,
yeah, I would argue that we're not at the edge. I would say that we're in the center of it. I would say that we're literally in the center of it all, and it is, these specialty fields are happening either because other fields are encroaching into our field or because specialties are branching out from within us. Like, for instance,
I like that description better.
Yeah. I mean, user experience and user interface, you know, I've been around long enough to know we've always been doing that. I mean, we've always, when you think about, I mean, we weren't always doing it in an efficient way. So if you think about, say, Flash websites, do you remember when Flash websites first came out? They were just so cool. And they were like, you had to dig into the interface to discover where the information was. It was like a game. Like, it was hidden in there. So we were already playing around with the user experience. Like, oh, you roll over this and suddenly music plays. And if you click it twice, then it opens up this new window. I mean, it was always very experiential. You know, what's changed is like, how efficiently can people get from one place to another? And how much information can you cram into the simplest interface possible? But you know, to me, it's a buzzword, because I feel like we've always been, I mean, if you think about just print, you think about a book or you think about a journal, that, you know, there's a user interface with that. There's a table of contents and there's the index and there's chapters and there's page numbers and, you know, there's small little pocketbooks and then there's big coffee table. I mean, those to me are also user experiences that, that we've always been involved in. You know, the way that I describe our role as designers is our role is to take information, take data and parse it in a way for the quickest, easiest, most efficient consumption of that information. So I often tell, you know, people about, you know, like the New York Times. I just read the New York Times and Washington Post like constantly. It's my go-to because I got off of Facebook. And basically,
good for you, by the way.
Yeah, that's a whole other story. But basically, our job is to take information and highlight the important parts and structure it in a way so that somebody can just scan the front page of a newspaper and say, I want to read that. I see that headline. I understand what that means. So I'm going to scroll down. It's not important right now. I want to see what's happening in this area. Oh, look at this headline. This sounds interesting. Let me dig in a little further. You know, that's because basically, you know, other people do the writing for us. And then we interpret that writing and present it in a way so that people get the value and the importance of different aspects of that content. And so to me, you know, that is our role as designers, parsing information, parsing data. And, you know, now you have like information scientists and data scientists and such. Yes, they do definitely very different things and they work with technology, but it's definitely also a field that is our own. And we should be sure to not kind of let other people usurp it.
Well said.
I'm very passionate about this.
You are. I love it. No, and that makes a lot of sense. Putting it in those terms.
So I just wanted to leave a little bit of time to see if you had any parting thoughts that you would like to talk about.
I think that our discipline is in a very exciting place. It's amazing how much growth there is, how many new programs there are. The one thing that I do find interesting is that there, you know, in addition to not teaching graduate students how to write, which is something that they really need to do, is if you go to graduate school and you don't plan on becoming an academic, there are certain things like areas like motion, and interactive, that is are both areas with great employment potential. And I find that programs are still teaching print basics. They're teaching type, for instance, they're teaching typography, talking about leading and kerning and pikas. And the reality is the majority, if you think about the information that you consume in a day, how much of that comes from a piece of paper and how much of that comes from something you're looking on your phone or watching on a screen? And so I think that we need to jump ahead and teach, you know, screen-based and motion-based design first and foremost. That should be our main focus before anything else, because that is the now and that is the future. And to spend a lot of time on print is a real disservice to the students. I don't know if that has anything to do with tenure promotions, but
no, but some really good advice for those out there that might be involved in curriculum revisions for their universities or departments.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. And if you're a graduate student, that's what you should be focusing on. And if you're developing curriculum, it's definitely what you should be focusing on.
Well, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
I hope that this is useful.
This concludes Season 2, Episode 6 of Tell It to Neil. If any of the facts or information included in this episode are incorrect, please feel free to get in touch through our email, hello@tellittoneil.com. If you would like to get in touch with Dan, please contact him through his website at www.dan-wong.com.